From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's been a decent amount of hand-wringing over the LDS Church's recent article about how Joseph Smith actually translated the Book of Mormon. The church was trying to focus on the role they say Joseph Smith played as a seer and what it meant to be a seer. But what most of us are really paying attention to is the seer stone. Because along with the article, the church published a photograph of one of the so-called seer stones, which they say Smith used to do the translation. And most everyone admits the image of Smith looking at this stone while peering into his hat, which is apparently how it worked, is strange. So today in the program, we're talking about the seer stone, not just how it worked, but how it fits into its time and what it tells us about the way Latter-day Saints understand Revelation. Join us after the news.
Hey, I'm Elaine Clark, one of the producers for Radio West, inviting you to check out Video West. It's our online showcase of short documentaries about the places and people that make Utah what it is. You can stream the films at videowest.kuer.org, and if you like what you see and hear, we hope you'll share it with your friends. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Apparently for years, there had been rumors the LDS Church was in possession of one of Joseph Smith's seer stones. It wasn't really a rumor for some historians and scholars who knew there was evidence the stone had ended up somewhere in the church archives. Last week, church officials published an article about how Joseph Smith actually translated the Book of Mormon, and the focus of that article was what it meant to be a seer. All Mormon prophets are described that way. But the officials also may have known about the rumors, and in this new spirit of transparency, they not only referred to the seer stone, they went one better and published a couple of photographs of the stone. So today in the program, we're talking about it. We've already received a few emails about the subject, and a couple of them are like this one from Doug, who asked this: if this seer stone was actually found while digging a well, which apparently it was, and if Smith used it also to hunt for treasure, which apparently he did, how can people say it's a reliable method for coming to truth? Well, that is not one of the questions we're going to tackle today, which isn't to say it's not a very good question. It's just that it's pretty tough to come to conclusions about matters of faith. Some, of course, are going to believe it. Some are going to think it's preposterous. What we're talking about today is how the seer stone was supposed to work for those who did believe. Also, we're exploring how these objects were used in the 19th century, because it wasn't just Mormons who used seer stones, by the way. We're also talking about what this tells us about the way Latter-day Saints understand Revelation. So, with that little preamble, we invite you to join us. If you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Joining us on the program throughout the hour is Matthew Bowman. He's an associate professor of history at Henderson State University in Arkansas, and he specializes in 19th century American Christianity. He's the author of The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith, and he's joining us today from his office in Arkadelphia, Arkansas. And Matthew Bowman, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Benjamin Park is also with us. He's a postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History at the University of Missouri, recently completed his doctorate in American history from the University of Cambridge. Benjamin Park is also an associate editor of the Mormon Studies Review. It's a journal that focuses on Mormon scholarship. He's joining us from a public radio station, KBIA, in Columbia. And Benjamin Park, welcome to you.
Glad to be here.
We should mention both Matthew Bowman and Benjamin Park are members of the LDS Church. We should also mention we extended an invitation to Richard Turley. He's an assistant historian for The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he's co-author of the article that we've been talking about. The church declined our invitation. They said they did not want to participate in a full hour dedicated only to seer stones, and we get it. Again, 801-585-WEST, the number to join the conversation. Well, Matthew Bowman, Benjamin Park, let's start with some basics. What do mainstream, you know, rank-and-file Mormons, what do they, before this was published last week, what do you think they understood about seer stones and a seer stone?
Well, I think in general they would have thought about the translation in a very general, miraculous fashion that was tethered to a biblical tradition of what's commonly called a Urim and Thummim, the narrative that's found in Joseph Smith's history that's part of the Mormon canon. Includes a reference of Joseph Smith receiving a Urim and Thummim with the golden plates in New York.
Which was what? Just explain what that was, because some people are like, what are you talking about? Yeah, what is a Urim and Thummim?
The Urim and Thummim, as described by several people of Joseph Smith's acquaintances, described it as a silver bow that ran over two different stones and connected them together, and that you would think they were called spectacles. That kind of makes you think that they might appear as a bigger version of seeing glasses of what we use today. And so when most members think of the translation of the Book of Mormon, they probably assume that it was mostly done through those instruments.
Right. But isn't that strange enough? You know, these two stones and these ancient spectacles. I mean, isn't that weird enough? I think for some people, if they believe the idea that that's exactly what happened, why would a seer stone make them distressed, if in fact it does, which I'm assuming it does some, for some reason?
Well, I think, and the article that will be published in the Engine, I think, gets at this a little bit. As Ben says, the Urim and Thummim has a deep, deep scriptural connection. It is described in the Bible. The words are used in the Bible. There's references in the Book of Mormon as well to an object like this. So that keeps it within the boundaries of what Americans today tend to think of as religion. The notion of a seer stone, on the other hand, to many Americans in the 19th century and today, seems in the realm of what people think of as magic. And I want to emphasize that those two categories are somewhat artificial. They are really just two versions of the same thing, which is accessing the power of the divine. But people tend to use the term magic to bracket stuff off from what real religion is, and thus magic may seem, as you say, weird, while religion may not.
Right. Now, some are going to argue that none of this is new, that the church has never really hidden the fact that Joseph Smith had a seer stone, and they've never really hidden the fact, because you can find it in church history, that he put this seer stone in his hat and then put his head in this hat to receive revelation, and that is technically true. But it also seems that from Joseph Smith on, we should also point out that church officials, Joseph Smith himself, tried to say as little as possible about the seer stone as they could. Is that not also fair?
I think that's very fair, and that's something that goes back all the way to Joseph Smith. One of the most poignant moments in this narrative of the instruments used in the translation of the Book of Mormon comes from 1831, where one of Joseph Smith's earliest converts, Ezra Booth, who was in the leadership ranks of the church, leaves the faith and starts writing these letters that get published as editorials in local newspapers that are attacking Joseph Smith and the Mormons. And in one letter published in October of 1831, he said that Joseph Smith, the Mormon prophet, quote, buried treasures were discovered several years since by means of a dark glass, the same with which Smith says he translated most of the Book of Mormon. Meaning, of course, going along with what Matt said, that by tying what is supposed to be the dismissive, fringe, laughable claims of treasure seeking, of glass, divination, with the Book of Mormon would be a way to relegate it. Well, a few weeks later, there's a big church conference where lots of church authorities gather, and Joseph Smith is asked by his brother Hiram Smith, well, why don't you get up and explain how the Book of Mormon translation took place? And Joseph Smith gets up, and instead of giving the details and perhaps saying, well, the seer stones might be seen as bad, but they worked for me, instead he goes, quote, it was not intended to tell the world all the particulars of the coming forth of the Book of Mormon. And from that point on, whenever he referred to the book, the translation, he would use vague phrases, mostly a phrase like, by the gift and power of God. And then the next year, they came up with the Urim and Thummim as a phrase to then place on both the seer stone and the instruments that were found with the gold plates. And from that point on, it had a biblical narrative that they thought vouched the particulars in a sense of scriptural validity.
So this is the thing that I wonder about then. I guess it wouldn't be technically accurate to say that Joseph Smith and or early Mormon church officials made up this idea of a Urim and Thummim. Of course, it existed biblically. As you say, it existed. At least references to it existed in the Book of Mormon. But did they concoct or reconstruct the idea of how the Book of Mormon was translated away from this idea of Joseph Smith sticking his head in a hat to something that sounded a little less magical, a little less crazy?
I think that is going a bit far, because I think, well, what Ben says is true, that you do see this tension in a sense that, you know, the seer stones might be classified by many people as magic and therefore not real religion.
Yeah.
But through the 19th century, it's incorrect to say that these things vanish entirely.
Right.
Wilford Woodruff had possession of this stone.
Yeah.
He took it to the dedication of the Manti Temple. Brigham Young had possession of this stone as well. And you see also many other spiritual objects or religious objects that are used in the church in the 19th century. Mm. So there certainly is, I think, a struggle going on to define what real religion is, what's within the boundaries of what is normal, quote-unquote,
right,
and what is weird, quote-unquote. But that is an ongoing tension. It's not something that's resolved right away in 1831. It goes on still today.
I need to remember to qualify when I say weird and strange. I need to say quote unquote too. I use it advisedly, but I think that some people do find it strange, and so may as well just say it. So where does he get it? Where does Joseph Smith get this particular? I know there were others, and we'll get to that in a moment. Where does Joseph Smith get this stone?
Well, it's unclear. There are probably at least three stones, maybe more than that. This one appears to have been found, as you say, when he was digging a well, in the company of a man named Willard Chase, who was part of another circle of seers in Palmyra. It's important, I think, to note that Joseph Smith was not the only seer in Palmyra. He did not own the only seer stones in Palmyra, New York. This was not something that was uncommon.
Right. And someone's digging a well, and they find this cool-looking stone. You know what's interesting, about this? I think a lot of people, when they saw the photographs, saw it as kind of less extraordinary than they expected, because it wasn't a crystal, or it wasn't transparent, or it didn't have a hole in it or anything like that. I mean, it's pretty, but it's kind of basic too. And I wanted to get your reactions to just the looks of it all, and whether you think that seer stones had to look extraordinary or be crystals or anything like that.
I think looking at it from today, we just see the sheer grittiness and materiality of these stones. It looks very earthen.
Yeah.
It looks something that, I mean, it looks polished, it looks clean, but other than that, it doesn't have anything that sets it apart from other things, but I think we're forgetting this historical distance between us and this frontier in the 1820s, 1830s, to where they were looking for the supernatural and everything. I mean, that was their way to be able to find a spiritual nature in the world around them. And even something as a brown, or what they called a chocolate-covered stone, was something that was not too far-fetched to believe as divine.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a really important point. And it's something that is useful to keep in mind when we're thinking about 19th century religiosity generally, particularly of this sort of folk variety that we see in early Mormonism. The tangibility of it, the physicality of it, the sense that you can pick up objects and use them to mediate between you and the divine, that's something that is purged in some ways from American Protestantism and from Mormonism, which is genetically Protestant, as the 20th century goes on, because we start to think of religion as something that's about ethics, about spirituality, that is internalized in you and is not manifest in the world. So these seer stones really remind us, I think, of an earlier way of being religious that is foreign to many Americans now.
Yeah, and no, I mean, it's so interesting because you look, there are plenty of examples of objects used in devotion in other religions. Mm-hmm. The Roman Catholic Church has, you know, this, you know, those relics. It seems like there are thousands of bones of St. Peter in churches through, you know, spread throughout Europe and throughout the world. I mean, you see stained glass windows and crosses in Protestant churches. In Judaism, you have, you know, yarmulkes, and you have other physical objects. In Islam, they have amulets, those kinds of things. So I guess we should point that out, that this fits into a bigger picture. This is not just Mormons, or this is not just frontier American religion.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. And I think that's really important to keep in mind. There are a couple of contexts in which you can view this stone. One is certainly a sort of a manifestation of American folk culture. But the other is, I think, this broader religious tradition in which tangible objects are used as a channel to mediate with the divine. You mentioned rosary beads, for instance, which are used as sort of a prayer device and a meditative device. Eastern Orthodox icons, I think, are a really excellent example of this as well, when people will pray and stare at these icons and be sort of transported into the divine presence and encounter the will and the presence of God by staring at them. So the seer stones, in that sense, I think, are part of a broader Western religious tradition, but they're also part of another tradition as well, which is this kind of tradition of divination and scrying, of looking into an object and seeing things that are not present before you. This goes all the way back to the classical world. Mirrors and still water were used in ancient Rome and Greece. The Middle Ages, you have this, you know, crystal balls, and it really persists to the present. In stories of, you know, when you're a child and you go in the bathroom and stare into the mirror and say, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, Bloody Mary, you're doing precisely what Joseph Smith did with the seer stones.
Wow.
When you do that, you're trying to touch something that isn't physical in front of you through this physical object that will mediate for you.
Does this also tell us something about, because I know that I know that you've mentioned there's a class element to this, which I want to sort of dig through a little bit later, but does this also tell us something about the people at the time, that they were, a lot of them were lived in, you know, subsistence lives, abject poverty, many of them. Certainly the whole Joseph Smith family never made much money. So the idea of treasure, and even the idea of more practical things like finding a well, finding water underneath the ground, I guess you have to add that into the equation, I suppose.
Right. Historians call this, both this period and this area, this geographic area where Joseph Smith is living on the frontier of New York at the time, or the rural Northeast, and possessive a supernatural economy that was concurrent with their developing capitalistic economy. And these seem like two strains that run contradictory, that at the same time that the market and that cultural life is becoming more complex or more modern, you still have these vestiges of this previous age. And these are developing in parallel lines. And in some ways, they're very intimately connected, because a supernatural economy took place at the same time that they were becoming frustrated with this natural economy, both with a abstract religious turn that Matt mentioned earlier in Protestantism, that they're not very happy of leaving the materialistic, earthly practices. And at the same time that there's the promise of the new American democracy of bringing more success and stability, and they're struggling out on the fringes of society, and treasure seeking is a way that, and not just treasure seeking, but a divine treasure seeking is a way that you can escape these problems. And so through these divine treasure seeking, it gave them power over the supernatural world at the very same moment that the physical world seemed to be teeming out of control.
So these physical objects were evidence in some ways of the fact
Absolutely.
That there was a God. Yeah.
Absolutely. And we sometimes like to talk about pre- and post-Enlightenment periods, that, you know, this moment of enlightenment happened in the 18th century, and ever since then we gave up our supernatural mystic beliefs and moved on to more rationality. Well, the Enlightenment was a lot more complex than that. It works in different stages. It works in different avenues. For many people, the Enlightenment encouraged these types of practices. For those practicing these folkloric beliefs, they believe that what they were doing was the essence of the Enlightenment. The world could now be measured, calculated, manipulated. They felt that they were scientists adapting their spiritual beliefs to a new world that required evidence, that required new ideas of logical proof. And that's what these stones, they believed, could capture.
So if I were a farmer, let's say a subsistence farmer living on the frontier of America at that time, wouldn't be unusual for me to find someone who possessed these gifts or possessed a stone or possessed a divining rod to help me find silver or gold or even water? I mean, that would not be unusual for that time?
No, it would not. It was, in fact, there's one historian, Alan Taylor, who's documented as many 40 different treasure quests that took place in Joseph Smith's neighborhood during this period. And those are just documented quests. You know, most treasure seekers did not leave written records of what they were doing. As another example, there was another fellow by the name of Silas Hamilton, who lived in Virginia, who kept a detailed journal of all these rumors of treasures that were hidden in the New England area. He included at least 44 different people who spoke of these different treasures in 32 different geographic locations in the rural Northeast. Even in the Palmyra area, there was one other seer who used seer stones by the name of Smith, just to give a random irony of the period. And I think you see this. This isn't just a wholesale carryover of past mystic traditions. It's adapted to their new times because they believe that, A, they infuse Protestantism with it, that you had to be worthy, you had to be spiritually clean to be able to enable these. That gave seer stones and divinization then a spiritual policing policy way that made sure that everyone followed their religious dictates. But it also played into the American sense of a self-made man because these weren't treasures that they believed that they would go out and just find. These were treasures that they had to work at. This is treasures that they had to work for. They had to put in the hours. They had to follow the rules. They had to, you know, follow the cultural dictates of these types of practices. So, they're both Protestantizing and Americanizing this practice of treasure seeking during this period.
What do we know about Joseph Smith's role in using the seer stone, a seer stone, or seer stones, because we should point out there were others. There was more than just one. What do we know about his using those stones to find treasure? There's a trial that he goes through in 1826, and I'm not sure what exactly we know about it. There's obviously some disputes about the particulars, but this is sort of the shady part of this story, if I can put it that way.
The trial is very interesting, and we should say that the charges were brought against Joseph Smith by the nephew of a man named Josiah Stowell, and this nephew felt that Joseph Smith was deceiving Josiah Stowell, was essentially bilking him, charging him a bunch of money, and not delivering on anything. But at the same time,
what was he supposed to be doing? Finding treasure?
Silver that Stowell believed was buried on his land. But at the same time, then you have Stowell as well, who is a prosperous and well-to-do farmer, who believes that Joseph Smith can, in fact, find buried treasure on his land and hires him to do it. So I think in the Stowell family here, you see this tension that I was talking about earlier, that many people do not find these practices. They do not find seer stones as incompatible with being a well-to-do, middle-class, prosperous American, while other people do find it strange and try to stamp out these practices by use of the law.
Yeah. It's interesting how he uses the seer stone, and there's kind of an evolution going on. I mean, at first, it's for the most ordinary kinds of things, it seems. I mean, there's one story I read from the 1820s, a man by the name of Martin Harris, early church leader, people who are familiar with the faith will know the name, where Joseph Smith used the seer stone to find a pin that Harris had dropped into some straw. So he kind of literally used it to find a needle in a haystack. So he used it for pretty ordinary purposes in some ways.
Yes, and this is what most of these stones were used for. A seer is one who can see things that are lost, who can see things that are invisible to the naked eye. And this, for many of these Americans, as Ben has been saying, this was about treasure because these were poor people living on the frontier and living in a land that they believed had had many, many other civilizations that had left things behind in it. But also you can use it for such mundane things as finding your lost keys, perhaps, these days.
What's interesting about Joseph Smith's practice of seership before the Book of Mormon days is that you have two facts that seem – or disputable facts that seem contradictory but coexistent. On the one hand, he never seems to find that much. Yeah. We don't have record of him succeeding. He never finds this big treasure.
Well, that's not lost on a lot of people.
Right, right. And then on the other hand, he's still well sought after.
Yeah.
And so I think that this speaks to a broader tension writ large with this seership practice in early America, that the excitement and the mania over this treasure seeking happens coexistent with this period of that they're not finding anything. So it almost speaks to the trenchant hopes they have in these practices.
Okay, we need to take a break. Matthew Bowman is with us. He is the author of the book The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith, teaches history at Henderson State University. Benjamin Park, also with us, postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Missouri, associate editor of Mormon Studies Review. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about the Seer Stone. It's what a lot of people are talking about around here ever since the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints last week released an article and published a photo of a Seer Stone. It's got a lot of people talking and wondering, us too. And we have with us historians Matthew Bowman and Benjamin Park to help us work through some of the issues here. Let me ask you both... how did it work? So what do we understand? How did he use this stone? He puts his hat on his lap, Joseph Smith, and then puts the stone in the crown of the hat, and then puts his face in there to exclude all the light. What do we know about how that worked, that process, if we do?
Well, that's about it. We have secondhand accounts of what's going on. We have plenty of people explaining the process of Joseph Smith shielding the light as he stuck his face in the hat. But what Joseph Smith sees and how that relates to treasure seeking or even the translation of the Book of Mormon, he remains silent on, which is tragic for historians trying to reconstruct how he explained his experiences. But I think it's significant to note the methodological holes we have in reconstructing it. And in fact, those who are most explicit in explaining what Joseph Smith saw, they had their own agendas behind it. They were speaking from decades later. David Whitmer, who is one of the witnesses to the gold plates and an early church leader, he was one of the most vociferous witnesses to the translation process. And he doesn't start talking until the 1870s, 40 years after the translation. He has a motive behind it. He wants to present Joseph Smith as merely a medium translating the words that are coming from the seer stone and almost trying to remove Joseph Smith from the process as much as possible. And that's why he says Joseph Smith saw words and therefore he just dictated almost like a secretary would just dictate minutes back to you. And so it's difficult to get into that process.
We have some comparative analyses of this sort of thing that I think can maybe help us understand what is going on here a little bit more. And again, we can look at other faith traditions and this kind of contemplative practice that these objects might induce. And that's something that goes, I think, even up to the 20th century into something called the Gansfield effect, which has been studied by people interested in ESP and things like that, which is this notion that focusing intently on a single object can aid in producing a state of sensory deprivation, which actually does, over time, induce trance states. It can induce a kind of contemplative state in which you are open, I think, more sort of emotionally, psychically, whatever, to perhaps outside influences or to kind of the center of your own soul, right? This sort of thing can induce a trance state, which makes you capable of experiencing things beyond your sort of regular state of existence.
And am I getting this right, that there are descriptions of Joseph Smith actually going into this kind of trance? There was, you know, blood draining from his face, I think I read, and his eyes going in and out of focus.
Right. There are again, as Ben says, kind of secondary sources, not Joseph Smith himself, right? As Ben says, all he ever says is it was by the gift and power of God. But there are descriptions of him receiving revelations. Most famously is the one that's now Section 76 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And observers described him as, you know, the blood draining from his face and that sort of thing. So it appears, right, that this may be something that is happening here.
It does raise a question of this idea of how you had to be, you had to have the gift. You had to be worthy. And this, there's a dispute that you've talked about. That he actually, Joseph Smith has this confrontation with another member of the early Mormon Church who also had a seer stone and also said he was receiving revelation through his stone from God.
That confrontation, I think, is interesting because you can see in that this struggle between these ways of thinking about what true religion is and how true religion works. If on the one hand you've got Page who says, well, we have these objects, right, that assist us in encountering the divine. We have these objects that are channels to the other world, and we can all have one of these, right? And we can all do this sort of thing. And Joseph Smith asserts that the important power is not in the object necessarily, but in his position as the head of the church, right? So you see, I think, a move away from this charismatic style of religion, this style of religion that emphasizes personal divine experience, and towards a more ecclesiological way of thinking about what religion is that emphasizes office and priesthood.
Hmm. Right. I think it may sound weird to us today, but there's a very democratic quality of these seer stones, right? If everyone finds the seer stone that can be a medium to hearing God's word, then that kind of cuts away at an authority figure. And so with these seer stones, that is almost a destabilizing presence within a growing movement that's going to become more hierarchical. Both Hiram Page in 1830 and then 7 years later there in Kirtland, another Mormon settlement, there's a boy by the name of James Brewster who claims that he's receiving revelations or divine commands through a seer stone. And Joseph Smith, just like he did with Hiram Page, makes him destroy the stone because those are seen as a challenge to the social order or the ecclesiastical order within the church.
One of the elements of the story that I think was surprising to a lot of people is that it turns out Joseph Smith may have used this seer stone to actually find these golden plates. And for the uninitiated, it's the golden plates that he finds. I'm sure most, at least in this area, know the story. He finds these golden plates, he says, drawn there by an angel, and then this is essentially the Book of Mormon that he translates. So how does this more public acknowledgement of a seer stone in the translation process, how does it change what Mormons and others are to make of the golden plates themselves? Because it seems like, as I look at it, he may not have even actually used the plates themselves. I mean, he looks like he put them somewhere, like he wrapped them in cloth and put them on a table, but he didn't actually thumb through them to translate. Am I getting that wrong?
No, yeah, that does appear to be correct, at least for the later portion of the translation. And I think it should make us think about what he meant when he used the word translation. You know, clearly he is not with the plates, you know, studying out this alphabet and rendering letters in Reformed Egyptian into English. That's not what he's doing at all. He uses the word translation in other contexts, right? It pops up in other scripture that he produces, particularly with reference to beings like Enoch, for instance, who ascends out of regular mortality and becomes kind of a divine figure. So the word for him appears to have connotations of bridging the gap between the human and the divine, bringing these two realms into contact, which of course is precisely what he's doing with the stones. And I think, you know, we can think of the plates in a similar way, that they are an object, which for him are a bridge to other worlds that you cannot see with your normal state of experience.
Does this at all raise the question, because I've heard this come up a few times, that possibly there weren't, in fact, then plates? This lets a lot of people, Mormons themselves who are skeptical about the whole process of that, it lets them off the hook a little bit, as to say that maybe there weren't actually plates. There wasn't actually a physical thing, but this was a more abstract concept that Joseph Smith was trying to relate. I mean, it doesn't get away from the fact that there were witnesses who said they handled the plates, they saw the plates, but this is a big bugaboo for a lot of people related to the plates, and I'm wondering if you have anything to say about that.
Well, I think even the most critical historians, and I'm thinking here maybe of someone like Dan Vogel, would say that there were plates. They would, as Dan does, they would doubt the origin of those plates.
Right.
Perhaps, you know, perhaps Joseph Smith made them himself, right? Or perhaps, you know, he found something that were not ancient Nephite records, but were something that could be passed off as such. But even still, right? And I think this is an area in which I think the discipline of religious studies more broadly can help us think through what's going on here. Ann Taves, who is a historian at UC Santa Barbara, has written about this recently and has argued that, yes, perhaps Joseph Smith did construct these plates, but he constructed them precisely to be a conduit to the divine, to be a focusing object. She compares the plates to the Roman Catholic host, right, which is simply bread that is made by human beings, but then through this kind of religious practice, the ritual that surrounds it becomes something very much more. And if we are inclined to say, as historians like Dan are inclined to say, that there were no ancient Nephite records, nonetheless, these plates were a powerful and important religious object anyway.
Matthew Bowman, you said something that I want to sort of come back. We were getting there, but you've talked about this idea of physical or tangible religion, about the way that these objects signal what you call a tangible religion. And explain what you mean, because you're saying that this isn't just folk magic, that there's something else going on, that it's also about material religion.
Yes, precisely. And I think, you know, that phrase folk magic, right, is a phrase that is used, I think, often to separate practices from what genuine religion was. And though these 19th century people would have used the term magic, they did not see the gap between legitimate religion and magic as thoroughly as we might. I think we are accustomed now, in sort of the Protestant, post-Protestant nation that we live in, to think about the important thing about being religious is that it teaches you to be a good person, that it helps you attain an inner sense of peace and satisfaction, that it gives you a community, that it does all these sorts of intangible things, usually orbiting around ethics and living right and living well. And that's one way of experiencing what religion is, but it's one that neglects, I think, an essential phase of religion for most of human history, which was this sort of tangible contact with the divine in a very real sense, experiencing the power of God in your life. And for many, many civilizations throughout human history, that is often mediated through material objects. Through ceremony, through costume, through iconography, through statues, to objects that might have power, be blessed. And that presence then of the divine, which has become largely spiritualized and intangible for Americans in the 20th century, was very, very important to people in earlier phases of history and was often manifest through physical things. I mentioned Eastern Orthodox icons earlier, and I think those are a very, very good example because they are still used. And icons are understood to be in that tradition the real presence of God in the same way that Roman Catholics teach that the real presence of God is in the host.
Yeah.
So you stare at this picture of Christ and you are actually in the presence of Christ as translated through that object. So that way of, I think, thinking about the presence of God in the world is foreign to many Americans who live in the sort of society that we have built today, but it's really essential for understanding how these things work.
And I think if you think of the material practice, even beyond the divine objects itself, if you look at the pictures that the church published in the new editions of the Joseph Smith Papers, you see that it's not just a seer stone, but a small sack that goes along with it.
Yeah.
And according to the record passed down, I'm not quite sure how exactly we know this, but it's told that the sack was made by Emma Smith. And that might seem as a very peripheral fact in the story, but if you think that this was Emma's way to be involved in the sacred project, she's not the one, she's not the seer, she can't read the text of the Book of Mormon or see hidden things, but she can at least manufacture the physical holding place in which a seer stone is held. And then after it passes through several people, after it's given to Oliver Cowdery dies, and his wife, Elizabeth Whitney Cowdery, keeps it in her possession. That's her connection to the divine. And so I think if we look around us and we kind of step outside of our post-Protestant mindset, as Matt thinks about it, I think we can realize that the materiality of our lives infringes on so much of our religious experience.
Yeah.
We need to take a break. Benjamin Park, postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Missouri, associate editor of Mormon Studies Review. We also have Matthew Bowman with us, author of the book, The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. He teaches history at Henderson State University in Arkansas. We'll take another break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the seer stone. Joseph Smith, founder of Mormonism, is seer stone. A photograph and an article published last week by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and we're talking about it with Matthew Bowman, associate professor of history at Henderson State University in Arkansas, and Benjamin Park, a scholar, postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History at the University of Missouri. So what does all of this tell us, gentlemen, about the Mormon process of revelation? Because it seems like the process changed. It evolved. I mean, there's evidence that Joseph Smith used the seer stone to receive revelation, and then he puts it aside, and then revelation becomes something different. What does that tell us about the way revelation? Because you could say that, oh, this is the way it's going to work. Mormons are going to use seer stones now to receive the word from God, but after the Book of Mormon, sometime later after that, I guess, he puts it aside. So what do we learn about revelation and how it works in Mormonism?
Something that struck me about the Ensign article that Richard Turley wrote with his co-authors that made me think about this. And in that article, he emphasizes very much the scriptural and biblical antecedents for these stones, which I think is a way to sort of bracket them into what religion is. But also, I think, is designed to help Mormons today understand that there can be, to borrow a famous term in religious studies, some varieties of religious experience. That the ways in which Mormons are accustomed to talking about the activity of God in the world today may be culturally bounded. In the same way in which Joseph Smith's experience with seer stones were also culturally bounded and conditioned by his expectations.
Which means what? That today we would not hear of, we'd have a harder time stomaching the idea that our religious leaders are getting information from a stone. You've got to find another way.
Precisely.
Yeah, okay.
And Mormons today expect revelation to happen in the ways that they are taught and brought up and explained that it will. But that doesn't necessarily have much to do with seer stones today. But it also, I think, helps us develop some historical consciousness, awareness that what we expect religion to be today is as much a product of our context and cultures as it was in the 19th century, and that what we experience today is not necessarily universal, and that it may evolve and change just as these experiences in the 19th century gave birth to how we live today.
Two episodes of early Mormonism that I think play what Matt was just explaining. The revelation that's now canonized in his Doctrine and Covenants section 1. It actually wasn't the first revelation received. It was received when the saints decided they were going to publish a number of Joseph Smith's revelations into a Book of Commandments, which later became the Doctrine and Covenants. And it was supposed to be the preface to the Doctrine and Covenants. And in it, it talked about revelation in the Mormon context. And it declared that God would speak to people in their weakness after a manner of their language so that they might come to an understanding. And I think this aspect of revelation speaking according to a person's language plays to these cultural contours. One other quote, about a decade later when Joseph Smith is in Nauvoo in a discourse, he says that if God were to speak to a little child, he would speak in the form of a little child. Which I think plays out that a central tenet of the Mormon claims to revelation is that everything is mediated through human beings, and not only that, but filtered through the surrounding culture of human beings. That's not just a side part of the Mormon religion, but it's part and parcel of the Mormon religion.
It's interesting how the official LDS Church and Joseph Smith and others, we talked about this earlier, start to back away from this idea of seer stones and divine dictation. It's something, Matthew Bowen, that you've talked about. They're backing away from this. They're changing. In the LDS essay, co-written, as we mentioned, by Richard Turley, he mentions how Joseph Smith had matured in his spiritual understanding. So it gets to the point, hey, I don't need a seer stone anymore. I've moved up and moved on, and so apparently has the church. Is that essentially how it worked, at least from their perspective?
That's at least how Joseph Smith saw it. Joseph Smith, we have an anecdote from his brother-in-law who speaks to him. This would have been 1829, 1830, where Alva Hale, who is Emma Smith's brother, says that Joseph told him that, quote, the gift of seeing with a stone and hat was a gift from God, but that peeping was damned nonsense. So, and later he tells Martin Harris that an angel appears to Joseph Smith in 1826 and tells him that if you want to be a true seer, you have to set aside these previous activities. So I think that was central to Joseph Smith's own narrative, and I think that the church then adopted that.
It's interesting also, Benjamin Park, you've talked about how there's this class element here, that the more affluent, maybe more educated members of the Palmyra Society and in the region saw this kind of folk magic. They began to see it anyway as kind of silly and superstitious and low. These were the frontier rubes who believed in this nonsense. We don't believe in that anymore. And maybe as Joseph Smith becomes more affluent, more respected, he moves away from that too. Is that a way of putting it?
Very much so. I think it's safe to say that Joseph Smith was far from alone in participating in these folkloric practices, and he also wasn't far from alone for later being embarrassed about it and later trying to put that away. I think one poignant quote comes from Lucy Mack Smith's memoir. Lucy Mack Smith was Joseph Smith's mother, mm-hmm. and when dictating her memoir decades later, she mentions something about folkloric practices, and she knows that this is going to sound bad, that this is going to sound bad from a class perspective. She is someone who's always worried about class throughout her narrative, and she says, I do not want the reader to suppose that we stopped our labor and went at trying to win the faculty of Abrac, drawing magic circles or soothsaying to the neglect of all kinds of business. We never during our lives suffered one important interest to swallow up every other obligation. But whilst we work with our hands, we endeavor to remember the service and welfare of our souls. And I think within that passage, it's such a trite acknowledgement of guilt, of embarrassment, but still a sense that they felt that along with this moving out of a social position, that we still wanted to find some spirituality, some working of grace within our cultural beliefs and practices.
So we're running out of time. I wanted to ask a couple more questions. What happens to the seer stone? I mean, there's one story that Brigham Young's brother actually steals it from the Cowdery family and then brings it back to Utah. Is that true?
Well, I don't know if stealing is the way to put it. After
That's my
Oliver,
term.
Yeah, Oliver Cowdery was Joseph Smith's right-hand man, and we have the story of 1830 or 1831. Joseph Smith gives Oliver Cowdery the stone and says, I don't need it anymore, right? This is part of his narrative of graduating from those practices to what he believed to be a prophethood position that was more dignified and doesn't need the crutch of a seer stone. Oliver Cowdery famously leaves the church several years later. He does briefly rejoin the church right before his death, but after he dies, the stone remains the possession of his wife. And I'm forgetting the name. Brigham Young's brother, it was Lorenzo
Phineas.
Young.
Phineas Young.
Thank you, Matt. He comes out and he visits the Cowdreys. He's married into the Cowdery family, so he knows them. And he asks if they can take the stone, and they give it to him. And he takes it back to Utah, where it remains a powerful relic to Brigham Young and others. And I think Matt mentioned before that Wilford Woodruff used it at the dedication of the Manti Temple. And then they kept it private. They'd sometimes show it to visitors who were close, usually family, descendants of Brigham Young, who felt that they had a right to see it and so forth. But it was never really seen in public until last week.
All right, let me ask you this finally, about a minute left. Although a big question for a minute, what does this do to Mormonism? I mean, there's this perception of Mormonism captured by, you know, the cartoon comedy South Park, that these kinds of stories just seem on the face of it really absurd. Does this underline that image? What does this do for the reputation of Mormonism broadly outside of the faith?
I think that, well, there's two audiences here, right? I think there's certainly the audience of Americans generally who have been brought up in a culture that's suspicious of these sorts of things. And, you know, South Park has already done what it will do for those people. But I think at the same time, I think that the frank discussion of the seer stone indicates that to those people who are interested in the study of religion, who are interested in the history of religion, this is signaling a real awareness of that conversation and a desire to participate in it.
Benjamin, quickly, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I think there's something about a visual picture of the seer stone that means that we are having to come to a reckoning of our historical context through which Mormonism was birthed. There's all these words that we can spill on pages and lectures, you know, online, but seeing the actual physical picture of the stone means something to how we view our past and our connection to it.
Benjamin Park, the postdoctoral fellow in the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Matthew Bowman, an associate professor of history at Henderson State University in Arkansas. He's the author of the book The Mormon People, The Making of an American Faith. Gentlemen, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, with thanks to Daniel Lombardi. The show directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.